As always, I've just been kind of wrestling. Where do we go from here in terms of the preaching? And before I went away on holiday, I just began to feel that I needed to move in the direction that I'm going to tentatively take a first step in today. If I feel it's right and have the life of God in it, we'll sustain it. Otherwise, we won't sustain it for that long. But 6 months ago, when I came back from, similarly from, I think, 3 weekends away, I'd been away in March and on the 1st of April for a few weekends, I came back and I began 6 months of preaching under the very loose title, Anything About Jesus. But I think it was that first day I was back was Easter Sunday. And either that Sunday or the Sunday after, I spoke about the significance of the resurrection. And I said, by way of introduction to that, that I was assuming the fact of the resurrection, that the resurrection really happened. We believe in it, there's evidence for it, but I'm taking that for as a given, and I'm proceeding to talk this morning, that's back in April, about the significance of the resurrection, the outcome, what it means for us because Jesus rose from the dead. And I kind of said in passing, perhaps next week or somewhere down the line, I will actually preach about that evidence. And I feel that's what I need to do. I feel that for a season. So I've been quite interested this morning that we've had a bit of an emphasis in the worship and in these testimonies. We've had a bit of emphasis on witnessing and being able to speak to people and having something to say to them. We've also had a bit of an emphasis on the mind. And I know it's been the mind in terms of overcoming lies with truth. But, you know, the mind is important in the title of one of the late John Stott's books, Your Mind Matters. And as charismatic Christians, we can often be accused of being anti-intellectual and of not using our minds. And God has created the mind. The devil hasn't created the mind. God has created the mind. And I know there's a kind of intellectualism which sets itself up proudly to be something that it's not and thinks that it can either find God or disprove God, and intellect alone can neither find nor disprove God. I know all of that, but your mind still matters. And it's good for us to know why we believe what we believe. And it's good for us to have thought through answers to some of the questions or objections that people will raise when we are witnesses. So if this has the blessing of God on it and there's life in it, I think for the next while I want to preach around some of the great proofs of the Christian faith, why we believe what we believe. And even if it's not, even if I'm preaching to the converted, literally in this case, and you believe anyway, and even if you've heard some of this, it's good for us to be refreshed. Well, there is a reason why we believe what we believe. This is not just pie in the sky. This is not just hoping somehow that what we believe is true and will all work out eventually. There's a reason for what we believe. And even if it's just to refresh our minds and with that our confidence and our boldness, and of course it's not just a mental thing, it spills over into the spiritual, because once our minds are made more certain, our faith is strengthened. But so if it's just for us, that's great. But I'm trusting it will give us confidence and boldness and answers for when we go on the streets. And having taken some weeks to look at some of the great proofs of the Christian faith, to then look at some of the current issues, the hot issues and the difficult issues that people have in considering the Christian faith, or that we have to contend with in our society today as Christians. And so none of that is in any way to say that we're now just going to be mental rather than emotional and spiritual, because I'd hopefully we'll be in the totality of our ministry and our meetings. We can be everything. But I do believe that when we feed our minds in the right way, it does actually have spiritual overflow and it strengthens our faith. So I'm going to start with that subject that I mentioned 6 months ago as I began another a preaching series. I'm going to start with this matter of the resurrection under the title, The Resurrection, History or Hoax. And it's going to be, I'm going to not try and do it all today because that would be too much. I will try and spread it over the two today and next week. And I'm going to be quite deliberate and quite careful about the outline, because obviously with this kind of preaching, there's a lot of material. And it's important that you have a clear outline of where I'm going with it. So I'm going to start with an introduction. I'm going to make two very important points by way of introduction so that we understand why this is an important matter. Then I'm going to look at two great facts that demand an explanation. And I'm going to establish those facts. And then I'm going to look at four theories. I'll only get to the first of the four, but four theories that have been concocted in the last 2,000 years to try and explain away those two facts. And finally, at the end of next week, if I get there in time, we'll look at a third great fact. And finally, then make some conclusions. Okay, so let me start with introduction. And I want to say two things by way of introduction. Firstly, that, and I know this is a long word, just stick with me, the historicity of the resurrection is crucial. In other words, the fact that it's historical. It's not just a fable. It's not a spiritual myth, which can, you know, that he didn't really die from rise from the dead, but that it's just it's kind of, you know, as liberal theologians love to say, he didn't literally or physically die from rise from the dead, but that Jesus rose in our hearts. Because what he had shared in his life, the truths that he has shared, the wonderful things that he did, will never be forgotten. So yes, he was killed. It was very disappointing. But on the third day, he rose again in our hearts, and we will remember him forever and remember the truths that he shared and live and try and do the things that he did. And so it's a, if you like, a figurative or a resurrection, a symbolic resurrection of what happens in our lives and our thinking and our feelings and our actions. It's a kind of, it's like a resurrection. That's not what we believe in at all. Okay, we believe in the fact that this is happened actually, physically, literally, and visibly. It's crucial. And it's crucial for two reasons. Because Jesus' credibility stands or falls by it. Jesus clearly predicted his resurrection. If this did not happen, then he was both inaccurate and a fool. Let me read you a quote. It was the same Jesus, the Christ, who, among many other remarkable things, said and repeated something which, proceeding from any other being, would have condemned him at once as either a bloated egotist or a dangerously unbalanced person. That Jesus said he was going up to Jerusalem to die is not so remarkable, though all the details he gave about that death, weeks and months before he died, are together a prophetic phenomenon. But when he said that he himself would rise again from the dead the third day after he was crucified, he said something that only a fool would dare say if he expected any longer the devotion of his disciples. Unless he was sure he was going to rise. No founder of any world religion known to men ever dared say a thing like that. Jesus' credibility stands or falls by whether he rose from the dead or not. More than that, Christianity itself stands or falls by whether Jesus rose from the dead. And you can read that very clearly in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul's great chapter on the resurrection. And amongst the other things that he says there, he says that if Christ was not raised, and there is therefore nothing after death, then first of all, our preaching and our faith is in vain. We are fooling ourselves and are the most, to be pitied the most of all men. We might as well eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. The significance of Christ's death remains uncertain, and we are still in our sins. And the power of death remains unbroken over us. The church would never have begun. The resurrection was the dominant theme and motivation of the early church's preaching. It would never have begun if it wasn't for that event. Where you stand with regard to the fact of the resurrection is no longer a matter of Christian theology. Christianity itself stands or falls with the resurrection. Michael Green, who was a well-known Christian leader and teacher and writer in this nation in the last century, says Christianity does not hold the resurrection to be one of many tenets of belief. Without faith in the resurrection, there would be no Christianity at all. The Christian church would never have begun. The Jesus movement would have fizzled out like a damp squib with his execution. Christianity stands or falls with the truth of the resurrection. Once disprove it, and you have disposed of Christianity. I'm trying to just ram home, before we begin the evidence, the importance of the resurrection actually having happened, literally, physically, visibly. And I shared recently at another occasion how Professor, how Josh McDowell, known to many of us as a great apologist, Christian apologist, was asked once by a student in one of his question and answer situations, situations, Professor McDowell, why can't you refute Christianity? Because that's what he set out to do. And he said, for a very simple reason, I am not able to explain away an event in history, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so, if the resurrection is so crucial to the Christian faith, the whole of, not only Jesus' credibility stands or falls by it, but the whole of the Christian faith stands or falls by it. It is not surprising, therefore, that the resurrection has come under such onslaught. Because the devil knows. In people's minds a doubt that this did happen or could have happened, and you've actually taken away the whole basis for believing on Jesus Christ and following him. That's my first point by way of introduction. The historicity of the resurrection is crucial. The fact that whether it happened or not, everything stands or falls in it. It's crucial. So the second point I want to make by way of introduction is this. Is that this is an historical investigable matter. We're not talking here about some spiritual belief or idea that can't be properly tested. There are many other religions that have some very weird and wonderful beliefs and legends about gods that came down and went floating off on this and riding off on that and, you know, cohabiting with this human and visiting this and doing that. And when you say to them, well, show me the evidence that it happened, they say, well, you've missed the point. That's why do you need evidence? This is a religious truth, not an historical truth. And so they evade any real examination of the foundations, as it were, of their faith, what's given rise to their faith. They evade any examination of that by saying, well, this is not an historical matter. It's not a physical, real-world matter. We want to say to you, the resurrection of Jesus Christ is a real-world matter. We say that this is something that actually happened in space and time, in a specific time, in a specific place, at a specific time. It's not some vague, general truth that we're speaking about. Either it happened or it didn't happen. If it didn't happen, well then, shut up shop right now, let's go eat and drink and be merry, and for tomorrow we die. If it did happen, fall on your face right now. It's that simple. It's an historical, investigable matter. You cannot keep the resurrection and its implications at a distance. You cannot reduce its import by relegating it to some religious or spiritual happening. It claims to be a literal, actual event like any other, and it can be investigated by the normal criteria for evidence and verdict. Again, I'm quoting Michael Green, Christianity is a historical religion. It claims that God has taken the risk of involving himself in human history, and the facts are there for you to examine with the utmost rigor. They will stand any amount of critical examination. Another author said this, the resurrection of Christ is an event in history wherein God acted in a definite time-space dimension. The meaning of the resurrection is a theological matter, but the fact of the resurrection is a historical matter. The nature of the resurrection body of Jesus may be a mystery, but the fact that the body disappeared from the tomb is a matter to be decided on by historical evidence. The place, I love this paragraph, the place is of geographical definiteness. The man who owned the tomb was a man living in the first half of the first century. That tomb was made out of rock in a hillside near Jerusalem and was not composed of some mythological gossamer or cloud dust, but as something which has geographical particularity. The gods put before the tomb were not aerial beings from Mount Olympus. The Sanhedrin was a body of men meeting frequently in Jerusalem. As a vast mass of literature tells us, the person Jesus was a living person, a man among men, whatever else he was, and the disciples who went out to preach the risen Lord were men among men, men who ate, drank, slept, suffered, worked, and died. What is there doctrinal about this? This is a historical problem. So it's important we emphasize these two things by way of introduction. The historicity of the resurrection is crucial. Jesus' credibility, and indeed the whole of Christianity, stands or falls by it. And secondly, it is a historical, investigable matter. And that's how we need to treat it. And we need to be able to demonstrate to people from the evidence that it actually happened. Most people reject the resurrection on the prejudiced assumption that there is no supernatural, nothing spiritual. They never investigate the evidence. Like Bertrand Russell, who wrote his infamous book at the turn of the last century, Why I'm Not a Christian. But if you go and try and read that book, not once did he actually even examine any of the evidence for the Christian faith. It was all just his subjective ideas and thinking, often based on his very negative experience as a child. Others reject the resurrection because there is a no analogy. In other words, they can't compare it to something else like that. They can't say, well, like you can do in most other things in this world, you say, well, I can believe it happened there because I see it happening here. And so they say there's no analogy, there's no precedent, and there's nothing so far anyway antecedent. There's nothing that's happened quite like it since then. So we can't accept it. And all I want to say is that this amounts to saying that nothing can happen for the first time. And that's the whole point that Paul makes about the resurrection, that Jesus was the first time, and it's not going to happen again till the end of the age, but it will happen again. He speaks about first Jesus, and then at the end of the age, us. You can't reject something simply because it's the only time it's so far that has happened. Because then you're saying nothing can happen for the first time. Some people say, well, we reject the resurrection because we can't prove it empirically. We can't go to a laboratory, recreate the conditions, and say, bang, there you are, we can demonstrate it. Well, there's a lot of things that this world believes that you can't prove empirically, evolution being one of them. My response to that is simply say, we can show that it is more reasonable, from the evidence, that it is more reasonable to believe in the resurrection than to not believe, than not to believe it. In fact, the evidence is so strong that I believe that in that sense of logic, we can prove it to us, logically, even if not empirically. And finally, just as a parting thought before we get going, I want to say, if you deny the resurrection, it is just as much your responsibility to prove that it did not occur. The historicity of the resurrection is crucial, and it is a historical, investigable matter. That's my introduction. So now we want to go on to the two great facts I spoke about. There are two great facts which demand acceptance or an acceptable alternative explanation. If you're not going to believe in the resurrection, how are you going to explain these two facts? There's a third that will come at the end, but there's two great facts that I want to share now, and then we'll look at the first of the four theories that have been concocted to explain away these two great facts. And the first fact, I've got them X, Y, and later on Z. The first fact is the empty tomb. And we want to say three things about the empty tomb. Firstly, that it was universally acknowledged. Friends and enemies alike accepted the empty tomb. Whether you read the Gospels, written some 30, 40 years later, or any other first century literature, extra-biblical literature or subsequent literature, no one ever contested the fact that Jesus' tomb was empty. Friends and enemies alike accepted the empty tomb. No one ever asserted that the body was still in the tomb. The only response was to find reasons why the body was not there. The action of the Jewish authorities, what did they do immediately after the resurrection? They went to the Romans and said, let's collude together and let's spread a rumor that the disciples came and stole the body. That very action is an admission of the fact that the tomb was empty. It shows their acknowledgement that the tomb was empty and that there was no point in trying to deny it. What was needed was an explanation as to why it was empty. The Jews had every interest in maintaining that the tomb was untouched, and yet they did not, as they could not. If they could have possibly managed to convince people that the tomb was not empty, they would have taken that route, but they never even tried. This admission extends to all subsequent Jewish documents. So the tomb is universally acknowledged. Secondly, it was easily checked. The empty tomb, easily checked. That the tomb was empty could be, and probably was, checked by anybody and everybody. Friends and enemies alike. A short Sunday stroll between your roast dinner and afternoon tea would have done the trick. Outside the city wall, check the tomb, it's empty. And yet nobody contradicted Peter's assertion of the resurrection in Jerusalem just 7 weeks later on the day of Pentecost, when he said that this Jesus has been raised. No one, not one voice contradicted and said, no nonsense, the body's still in the tomb, we've checked it. His hearers would have had to have known about the indisputably empty tomb to have accepted his incredible message about the resurrection. Indeed, in the preaching of the early church, no mention is ever made of, or any debate is ever entered into about the empty tomb. There was simply no point in arguing about it. Everyone knew it was so. The only points worth arguing about were why it was empty and what this proved. The resurrection message could not have survived for one day if the empty tomb had not been universally established. We have the rapid rise of this teaching of the resurrection without opposition. So the empty tomb was universally acknowledged. It was easily checked. And we can say thirdly and lastly on this point of the empty tomb, It's very significant that no shrine developed. It is significant that the tomb did not become a shrine in the years following, either for Christians or for others who had known Jesus. The disciples, the woman, or Paul never visited the tomb, simply because they knew the body was not there. He was not there. Why make an issue of the tomb? And we need to realize or notice that this is completely contrary to the normal human tendency to enshrine and sacralize places and objects that have been associated with great men, particularly religious men or religious founders. Look at any other religion in the world and you have shrines around the place where they died or the places that they went to or the things that they did. Shrines develop, and unfortunately even in the history of the Christian church, where the Christian faith has departed from its biblical roots and brought in other ideas and teaching, you also have shrines. But in a biblical church, you never have shrines. And the early church never ever made a shrine out of the place where he was buried, which they surely would have done if the tomb hadn't been empty. So that's the first great fact, which either demands acceptance or an explanation, an alternative explanation, the empty tomb. The second great fact, why? The appearances, the post-resurrection appearances. Recognizing their importance, Paul and Luke stress the post-resurrection appearances of Christ. 2. Mary Magdalene, the woman returning from the tomb. Peter, later in the day, at least twice to the apostles in Jerusalem. The disciples on the road to Emmaus. 7 of the apostles on the Sea of Galilee. 500 plus believers at the same time. James, the brother of Jesus. The apostles once again on a hill in Galilee, and again to them on the Mount of Olives when he was ascended. And after the ascension, that's 10 times, and after the ascension to Stephen, Paul, John, and many hundreds since. Post-resurrection appearances. At least 11 times over 40 days, in the words of Luke, he showed himself to them and gave them convincing proofs that he was alive. They touched him and saw him eat and drink. And C.S. Lewis says, the first fact in the history of Christendom is a handful of people who say they have seen the resurrection. If they had died without making anyone else believe this gospel, no gospels would ever have been written. 2 great facts, the empty tomb and the post-resurrection appearances. How are we to explain them? So let's get from our introduction, 2 points, 2 great facts, we've seen what they are, to the theories concocted to explain away these 2 great facts. And in 2,000 years, only 4 theories have been found by skeptics as an alternative to the resurrection. And we'll look at them in due course, 1 today, the other 3 next week. But we need to just say this before we start about these 4 alternative explanations, these 4 theories. Apart from each one being highly illogical and untenable and contradictory to the evidence, an additional difficulty is that 3 of the 4 only explain 1 of those 2 great facts. So you actually need at least 2 theories to explain away the 2 great facts of the empty tomb and the post-resurrection appearances. The problem is that if you try and take any 2 of those theories and use both of them, they are mutually self-contradictory. You can't actually have more than one. You'll see how this is later on when I talk about these theories. But apart from that, in themselves, they are illogical, untenable, and contradict the evidence. You need more than, so already you can discard it. But even if you didn't discard it, you need another one to explain away the other of the 2 great facts. And actually, as soon as you try and hold both those theories, they contradict each other. You can't do that. The evidence must be considered as a whole. It is fairly easy to find an explanation for one particular part of the resurrection story. But such explanations are valueless unless they fit in with both the other explanations and the other parts of the story. A number of explanations which might individually fit part of the story, but which taken together don't cohere into an intelligible pattern, can provide no acceptable alternative to the single interpretation which fits the whole, namely the resurrection. This is a given, and it is up to the skeptics to find an alternative. So let's go to the first of the, wander away from the microphone. I feel this is an important recording because apart from the fact that some of us may want to hear this at times to just kind of shore up our own faith, our own understanding, it may well be that we want to work through some of this material as part of our witness and answering questions to people. It may even be that the recording itself we want to give to people. So help me not to move away from the microphone. I need to have my funny little spaceman outfit on next time, maybe. I need to slow down. Sorry. You can see I haven't preached. It's not just the 3 weeks I was away. I mean, the 3 weeks before that, I think I didn't get to preach either. Because there's a morning meeting which just didn't work out. Then Melita preached, and then there was another morning meeting where it didn't work out. So it's actually about 7 or 8 weeks since I last preached. It's like a pent-up flood. Thank you, Johnny. So the first theory, the one we'll look at today. This is the only one of the four theories which attempts to explain both the empty tomb and the post-resurrection appearances. The other three only, as I've said, only will try and explain one or the other. So in themselves, this is the only one that tries to explain both, and yet actually it's the weakest of the theories, and it is what has become known as the swoon theory. And the idea of this is that Jesus didn't actually die. He went through everything he went through, and because of the pain and the suffering, he went into a deep swoon, an unyielding swoon. And everyone thought he was dead, and he wasn't. And of course, it's primitive of medicine in those days, and they couldn't really be sure, and they wrongly certified him as dead. But then, in the coolness of the tomb, and aroused by all the spices that he was buried with, he revived. And he came out of the tomb, and the disciples were so overjoyed and amazed and shocked and overwhelmed by having him back that they weren't satisfied with preaching a message merely of resuscitation. It had such an incredible emotional effect on them, they had to actually change the message into a message of resurrection, because to them it was like a resurrection. Now that's, in short outline, that's the swoon theory. And if it was right, it would explain both the empty tomb and the post-resurrection appearances. But can we believe it? And I want to respond to it with 2 points. Obviously, much evidence to substantiate the 2 points, but there's 2 points here with which I want to make to refute the swoon theory. First, and the first point is certain death. Certain death. And I won't number them because it's almost overwhelming, but I'm just going to run through all the things which point to the fact that Jesus couldn't have swooned, there was certain death. So, in increasing order, if you like, of increasing import, consider all these points. The fact that he had no sleep the night before. He was kept awake all night at the so-called trial that he had. He had no nourishment since that final meal, the Last Supper, with his disciples. So for nearly 24 hours by the time he died, and well over 72 hours by the time he rose, he had no nourishment. Consider the loss of blood, which he had had in all the various tortures that he went through, both before and during the crucifixion. Consider the fatigue caused by horrendous pain. Consider the fact that he would have been further weakened by the intense emotional and spiritual agony of everything he went through. That moment where the Father put the judgment for the sin of mankind on him on the cross, and there was that separation. Consider that amongst what happened to him before he was crucified, that apart from the mocking and the being dressed up and all these things that happened to him, but in blunt language, the worst thing possible that happened to him when the soldiers mocked him was that they beat him over the head with a pole. Consider the crown of thorns and the incredible pain of having thorns pressed down into your scalp. Then consider the scourging or the whipping that he was subjected to. He was tied to a pole and whipped with a particularly nasty item in the Roman world called a flagrum, which was a long piece, often of leather, but it had bits of sharp bone or metal that were sewn into the whip. And these pieces of bone or metal would have lacerated the flesh and actually torn away pieces of the flesh. Eusebius, who was a historian in the 3rd century, said this, And he said this as an eyewitness to Roman flagellation. He said, the sufferer's veins were laid bare, and the very muscles, sinews, and bowels of the victim were open to exposure. And the Romans, unlike the Jews, because of the Torah, the Romans did not limit the number of strokes. And in this case, it wasn't the trained lictors or whippers that were used. They were just brute soldiers. Consider all of the suffering and the pain and the loss of blood from that scourging. Then consider the stripping and the redressing of Jesus on that raw flesh that had been exposed, with the crown of thorns, the beating around the head with a pole, and the whipping. Then consider the journey to Calvary, where it says they brought him to Golgotha in the Gospels. And that suggests that he already was so weak that he was unable to move by his own power. And that he was roughly manhandled and virtually dragged there. They brought him. And then, of course, consider the crucifixion itself. And this is a description a medical doctor gave of crucifixion and what it would mean for the physical frame of a human being. For indeed, a death by crucifixion seems to include all that pain and death can have of the horrible and ghastly. Dizziness, cramp, thirst, starvation, sleeplessness, traumatic fever, tetanus, shame, publicity of shame, long continuance of torment, horror of anticipation, mortification of untended wounds. All intensified just up to the point at which they can be endured at all, but all stopping just short of the point which would give to the sufferer the relief of unconsciousness. The unnatural position made every movement painful. The lacerated veins and crushed tendons throbbed with incessant anguish. The wounds, inflamed by exposure, gradually gangrened. The arteries, especially at the head and stomach, became swollen and oppressed with surcharged blood. And while each variety of misery went on gradually increasing, there was added to them the intolerable pang of a burning and raging thirst. And all these physical complications caused an internal excitement and anxiety which made the prospect of death itself, death, the unknown enemy at whose approach man usually shudders most, bear the aspect of a delicious and exquisite release. And then after the crucifixion, consider next, under this point of certain death in response to the swoon theory, consider the blood and water. Samuel Houghton, the great physiologist from the University of Dublin, relates his view on the physical cause of Christ's death. Just to say, if you're not acquainted with it, that John's Gospel speaks about a flow of blood followed by a flow of water. That happened when, after Jesus gave up the spirit and died, the Roman put a spear into his side. A flow of blood followed by a flow of water. And this is what this doctor had to write, this physiologist. When the soldier pierced with a spear the side of Christ, he was already dead. And the flow of blood and water that followed was either a natural phenomenon, explicable by natural causes, or it was a miracle. That St. John thought it, if not to be miraculous, at least to be unusual, appears plainly from the comment he makes upon it, and from the emphatic manner which he solemnly declares his accuracy in reporting it. Repeated observations and experiments made upon men and animals have led me to the following results. When the left side is freely pierced after death by a large knife, comparable in size with a Roman spear, three distinct cases may be noted. First, no flow of any kind follows the wound, except a slight trickling of blood. This is that which usually occurs. Second, a copious flow of blood only follows the wound. The second is found in cases of death by drowning and by strychnia, and may be demonstrated by destroying an animal with that poison, and it can be proved to be the natural case of a crucified person. Third, a flow of water only, succeeded by a few drops of blood, follows the wound. The third is found in cases of death from pleurisy, pericarditis, and rupture of the heart. Now, with these three foregoing cases, most anatomists who have devoted their attention to the subject are familiar. But there are two further cases readily explainable on physiological principles, but not often recorded in the books, except by St. John. Nor have I been fortunate enough to meet with them. Fourth, So fourth possible thing that can happen after death, putting a knife the size of a Roman spear into somebody's side. A copious flow of water succeeded by a copious flow of blood follows the wound. And fifth, a copious flow of blood followed by a copious flow of water, which is what happened, which is what John describes. Death by crucifixion causes a condition of blood in the lungs similar to that produced by drowning and strychnia. The fourth case would occur in a crucified person who had previously to crucifixion suffered from pleuritic effusion. And the fifth case would occur in a crucified person who had died upon the cross from rupture of the heart. The history of the days preceding our Lord's crucifixion effectually excludes the supposition of pleurisy, which is also out of question if the blood first and water afterwards followed the wound, which is what John describes. There remains, therefore, no supposition possible to explain the recorded phenomena, i.e. what John described, except the combination of crucifixion and rupture of the heart. John was so astonished by what he observed and was somehow convinced by the Holy Spirit that it was highly significant, and he stressed in his narrative both the event and the truthfulness of his testimony. If you go and read it there, it's amazing how John makes such an issue about this flow of blood followed by a flow of water that he saw, saying that I saw it and I'm being truthful in saying so. It's all the more clinching because John couldn't have known the medical significance of what he saw. So that he couldn't have invented it to deceive us. Had Jesus been alive, strong spouts of blood would have emerged with every heartbeat. Instead, the observer noted semi-dark red clots seeping out, distinct from accompanying watery serum. This is evidence of massive clotting of blood in the main arteries and is exceptionally strong medical proof of death. Certain death, not a swoon. Next, and as part of the evidence for certain death in refutation of the swoon theory, is that the Romans believed Jesus was dead. Crucifixions were common. The soldiers knew their job, and they killed a man when they had to. That's the bluntness of it. They were used to the evidences of death. They knew a dead man when they saw one. The centurion saw Christ die, as says in the gospel, and when the centurion who was standing right in front of him saw the way he breathed his last, he was convinced, and his head was going to roll if he got it wrong. He was convinced that Jesus had died. Pilate then required certification of Jesus' death, and in Roman practice that required examination by four executioners. It's just make-believe to say that he didn't die and the Romans got it wrong. Then the Jews believed Jesus was dead. They asked Pilate for a guard to prevent theft of the body by the disciples, indicating acceptance of the fact that Jesus had died. The friends believed Jesus was dead. Joseph and Nicodemus, who in preparing the body for burial had the closest contact with it, saw no sign of life. Then we come to the tomb. Jesus was buried in strict accordance with Mosaic law and Jewish custom. We know more about his burial than that of any other person in the ancient world. Joseph took Jesus' body to his own tomb as it was nearby and time was short. The Sabbath, remember, started at 6 o'clock that night. It was now well after 3 in the afternoon. It was common for rich people to have such personal tombs prepared well in advance. A cave was hewn horizontally out of a rock with a single entrance. Into this tomb, Jesus' body was placed. And we would have to say that the contact of the body with cold stone, even if somehow everybody had got it wrong, and John had invented something which he couldn't possibly have known to invent, and the Romans and everybody else got it wrong, we'd have to say that the contact of the body with a cold stone would have been enough to bring on syncope through the congelation of the blood, owing to the fact that Jesus' regular circulation was already massively checked. Far from being revived in that tomb, the tomb would have killed him. Also, a man in a tomb is not revived by being shut up in a cave, but by being brought out into the open air. And Jesus was shut up in a cave. And then last but not least, when it comes to the evidence for certain death, we have the grave clothes and the spices. And I want to speak about those together. And Merrill Tenues has written some outstanding stuff Christian Reference Works says this about the grave clothes. In preparing a body for burial, according to Jewish custom, it was usually washed and straightened and then bandaged tightly, the details are important, bandaged tightly from the armpits to the ankles in strips of linen about a foot wide. Imagine strips of linen a foot wide all the way around the body, from here down. Aromatic spices, often of a gummy consistency, were placed between the wrappings or folds of the linen. They served partially as preservative and partially as a cement to glue the cloth wrappings into a solid covering, virtually to mummify the body. Missionaries and natives of Syria tell us that it is still customary to wash the body and to swathe the hands and feet in grave bands, usually of linen, and to cover the face or bind it about with a napkin or handkerchief. It is still common to place in the wrappings of the body aromatic spices and other preparations to retard decomposition. We are told that after the burial of Jesus, Nicodemus bought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds. That's a lot. And they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen wrappings with the spices, as the custom of the Jews is to bury, and that Mary Magdalene and two other women bought spices subsequently for the same purpose. It was customary in Jesus' time to use a great quantity of spices for embalming, especially for those held in high esteem, as Jesus was. What were those spices? Aloes, a fragrant wood, pounded to a fine dust. Myrrh, an aromatic gum. Now, you know what happens when you add gum to fine wood shavings or wood dust. It becomes glue, doesn't it? An aromatic gum adhering so closely to the body that grave clothes could not easily be removed. Nard, a semi-liquid unguent with which the body was normally anointed. In haste, Jesus' body was not anointed, and that's probably what the woman came for subsequently. And the spices were wrapped around the body between the linens with a roller and over the head and face with a napkin. And so the spices were tightly forced over your face. What are the implications of this? The napkin would have tightly wound around the face, would have smothered any remaining life, even if Jesus had swooned and not died. Not only that, the overpowering odor in a sealed space would have killed a sick person whose brain was already seized with the most unyielding swoon. So far from the grave clothes and particularly the spices adding to Jesus' recovery, you know, revival from the swoon, actually both the grave clothes and the spices would have been enough to kill a man in his situation, even if he hadn't already died, which he clearly had. What about the grave clothes and spices after the resurrection? It's quite amazing. John and Peter found the grave clothes, not strewn about the tomb, but exactly where the body had been. And the napkin was still wrapped, was apart, with a gap where the neck had been. If you look very closely, and it's also some of the Greek, which I'll mention in a moment, that's what's described. The grave clothes and the napkin, separate, just with a gap where the neck would have been. Everything looked as if the body had simply withdrawn. John, at once seeing the significance of this, the gospel says, immediately believed. It was the position of the grave clothes that actually caused John to believe. Because what he saw was not something that could possibly have happened unless something supernatural had taken place. Whether it was Jesus himself from the inside or even other people from the outside could not have done and left behind what John saw when he came into the tomb. And immediately seeing what he saw, he believed. If the body was to withdraw, the body clothes would have remained where they were, but would have collapsed under the weight of 100 pounds of spices. Then there would be a space, and then the napkin, because of its complicated crisscross pattern, it would have retained its rounded concave shape that it would have had around the head. And this is exactly what the disciples saw. The linen where it was, but collapsed under the weight of the spices, the napkin still retaining its round concave shape. The Greek for lying in "they saw the linens lying there" means collapsed. The napkin, by contrast, was not lying, but folded up. Some translations, wrapped up, rolled up. It's a different Greek word. The Greek here means twirled, aptly capturing the rounded shape, which the napkin still preserved. Further, the statement in the Gospel, the napkin was not lying with linen clothes, would be meaningless if the linen clothes had been strewn all over the tomb and were not in one definable place. Also, the two angels who appeared to Mary Magdalene, says in the Gospel, sat where the body had lain, one at his feet and one at his head. Now, Mary could not possibly have known those two places apart if the grave clothes weren't still in position. If it was just a mess and everything was strewn about the place, how would she have possibly known one was at where the feet were and one was where the head had been? And more incredibly, no spices were visible anywhere in the tomb. Had the clothes been disturbed, had they been unwrapped by somebody else or by Jesus himself, the 100 pounds of aloes and myrrh would have fallen into a heap somewhere on the floor. It's rather bulky and unmistakable. What are the implications of this? Owing to the cementing myrrh, it is actually very difficult to unwrap grave clothes, let alone wrap them up again neatly together afterwards, and to do both of these without disturbing any of the spices. In short, it is impossible for a revived Jesus, had he come into a swoon, and now he revived, it is impossible for the revived Jesus to have removed himself from his grave clothes, tightly wrapped from the armpits down. It's just impossible with all this gummy consistency and so forth. And it is virtually impossible for anyone else, similarly, to have removed the body from the grave clothes. You may well ask then, well then how did the body get out? Well, only supernaturally, and that's just the point. The resurrection is supernatural. No, there is no other explanation for the presence and the position of the grave clothes and the spices other than the resurrection. And so my first point in refuting the swoon theory is simply certain death. Jesus did not swoon, he died. And my second point, which I've begun to imply already, but I make now, is recovery impossible. Certain death and recovery impossible. I've given, if you had been counting, something like 20 reasons why Christ must have died and not merely swooned. But even if he did swoon, the recovery which the swoon theory ascribes to him is impossible. After all that suffering, in his weakened state, and without aid for 36 hours, Jesus would have had to do a number of things. Unwrap the grave clothes from the inside, which we've seen is impossible. Have the strength to tear apart the cemented folds without disturbing the spices, and then have the presence of mind to wrap them up again. Then he would have to move the stone, which we haven't even got to yet. More of that when we look at some of the other theories. Then he would have had to break the seal. Again, we haven't looked at the seal yet. We'll get to that next week. Then he would have had to evade the guard. Again, more of that next week. Then he would have had to very quickly appear healthy and strong to his disciples. Then he would have had to deceive them regarding the resurrection for the rest of his life, which contradicts everything we know about him. Then he would have had to retreat into and die in obscurity. Which again, we just have to say is very unlikely. And then the disciples would have had to agree to the myth of the resurrection. And again, that's inconsistent with everything we know about them. And it's highly unlikely that they would have been able to maintain that conspiracy and be in agreement about it, even though it cost nearly all of them their lives. And just as a PS, a merely resuscitated body, a body that had come out of a swoon, would not have had the superhuman properties that Jesus' resurrected body had. So the swoon theory, the first of the four theories that have emerged over 2,000 years to explain away the resurrection, is the only theory which, if it was tenable, does explain both of these two great facts, the empty tomb and the post-resurrection appearances. And yet, it is the weakest of the theories. I would say it's impossible to believe it with any integrity because of certain death and impossible recovery. So we'll continue next week and complete the proofs for the resurrection of Jesus Christ, history or hoax. And I'm hoping that in this season, as we look at this and other proofs and at other issues that face us, God will use this way also of equipping us. It's a way, it's not the way, but as a way of equipping us, not only in our own faith, in the certainty and the strength of our own faith, but to help us as we seek to be witnesses in our world and to see and to have influence and impact. So it's great to be back. We'll be back live at 5 this afternoon. I'm just back from holiday last night. I haven't a clue what's happening, what we're doing. But let's come together at 5 o'clock and just meet with the Lord. Okay? And let's have some fellowship together now. Thank you.